sooner or later. The guys who hired the Gothics and Casuals to keep us here, they're gonna come for us. When they do, we take them. We get at least one of them alive. Same time, we're on our way out, and the Goths and all, they won't expect all the firepower, so we get to the street and head for the projects.
I think that about covers it, Jammer said, strolling across the carpet to the locked and curtained door. I think that about sums it up.
He pressed his thumb against a coated latch plate and pulled the door half open.
Hey, you! He bellowed. Not you. You with the hat! Get your ass over here, I want to talk!
The pencil-thick red beam pierced door and curtain, two of Jammer's fingers, and winked over the bar. A bottle exploded, its contents billowing out as steam and vaporized esters. Jammer let the door swing shut again, stared at his ruined hand, then sat down hard on the carpet. The club slowly filled with the Christmas tree smell of boiled gin. Beauvoir took a silver pressure bottle from the bar counter and hosed the smoldering curtain with seltzer, until the CO2 cartridge was exhausted and the stream faltered.
You're in luck, Bobby,
Beauvoir said, tossing the bottle over his shoulder.
'Cause Brother Jammer, he ain't gonna be punching any dick.
Jackie was making clucking sounds over Jammer's hand, kneeling down. Bobby caught a glimpse of cauterized flesh, then quickly looked away. Chapter 26 The Wig.
You know, Rez said, hanging upside down in front of Marley, it's strictly no biz of mine, but is somebody maybe expecting you when we get there? I mean, I'm taking you there for sure, and if you can't get in, I'll take you back to Jalterm. But if nobody wants to let you in, I don't know how long I want to hang around. That thing's scrap, and we get some funny people hanging out in the hulks out here.
Rez, or Therese, Marley gathered from the laminated pilot's license clipped to the Sweet Jane's console, had removed her canvas work vest for the trip. Marley, numb with the rainbow of derms Rez had pasted along her wrist to counteract the convulsive nausea of space adaptation syndrome, stared at the rose tattoo. It had been executed in a Japanese style hundreds of years old, and Marley woozily decided that she liked it. That, in fact, she liked Rez, who was, at once, hard and girlish, and concerned for her strange passenger. Rez had admired her leather jacket and purse before bundling them into a kind of narrow nylon net hammock, already stuffed with cassettes, print books, and unwashed clothing.
I don't know, Marley managed. I'll just have to try to get in. You know what that thing is, sister?
Rez was adjusting the G-web around Marley's shoulders and armpits.
What thing?
Marley blinked.
Where we're going. It's part of the old Tessier Ashpool chorus. Used to be the mainframes for their corporate memory.
I've heard of them, Marley said, closing her eyes. Andrea told me.
Sure, everybody's heard of them. They used to own all of Freeside. Built it, even. Then they went tits up and sold out. Had their family place cut off the spindle and towed to another orbit. But they had the cores wiped before they did that, and torched them off and sold them to a scrapper. The scrapper's never done anything with them. I never heard anybody was squatting there. But out here, you live where you can. I guess that's true for anybody. Like they say that Lady Jane, old Ashpool's daughter, she's still living in their old place. Stone crazy.
She gave the G-Web a last professional tug.
Okay. You just relax.
I'm gonna burn Jane hard for 20 minutes, but it'll get us there fast, which I figure is what you're paying for.
And Marley slid back into a landscape built all of boxes. Vast wooden Cornell constructions where the solid residues of love and memory were displayed behind rain-streaked sheets of dusty glass. And the figure of the mysterious boxmaker fled before her down avenues paved with mosaics of human teeth. Marley's Paris boots clicking blindly over symbols outlined in dull gold crowns. The boxmaker was male and wore Alan's green jacket and feared her above all things.
I'm sorry,
she cried, running after him.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. Therese Lorenz, the sweet Jane. You want the numbers? What? Yeah, sure, we're pirates. I'm Captain fucking Hook already. Look, Jack, let me give you the numbers. You can check it out. I said already, I got a passenger. Request permission at goddamn cetera. Marley something speaks French in her sleep.
Marley's lids flickered, opened. Rez was webbed in front of her, each small muscle of her back precisely defined.
Hey,
Rez said, twisting around in the web.
I'm sorry. I raised them for you, but they sound pretty flaky. You religious?
No,
Marley said, baffled. Rez made a face.
Well, I hope you can make sense out of this shit, then.
She shrugged out of the web and executed a tight backward somersault that brought her within centimeters of Marley's face. An optic ribbon trailed from her hand to the console. And, for the first time, Marley saw the delicate sky-blue socket set flush with the skin of the girl's wrist. She popped a speaker bead into Marley's right ear and adjusted the transparent microphone tube that curved down from it.
You have no right to disturb us here,
a man's voice said.
Our work is the work of God, and we alone have seen his true face.
Hello? Hello, can you hear me? My name is Marley Krushkova, and I have urgent business with you. Or with someone at these coordinates. My business concerns a series of boxes, collages. The maker of these boxes may be in terrible danger. I must see him.
Danger? The man coughed. God alone decides man's fate. We are entirely without fear. But neither are we fools.
Please listen to me. I was hired by Josef Virik to locate the maker of the boxes. But now I have come to warn you. Virik knows you are here, and his agents will follow me.
Rez was staring at her hard.
You must let me in. I can tell you more.
Virik!
There was a long, static-filled pause.
Josef Virik?
Yes, Marley said. That one. You've seen his picture all your life, the one with the King of England. Please. Please.
Give me your pilot,
the voice said, and the bluster and hysteria were gone. Replaced with something Marley liked even less.
It's a spare,
Rez said, snapping the mirrored helmet from the red suit.
I can afford it. You paid me enough.
No, Marley protested. Really, you needn't. I
She shook her head. Rez was undoing the fastenings at the spacesuit's waist.
You don't go into a thing like that without a suit, she said. You don't know what they got for atmosphere.
You don't even know they got atmosphere.
And any kind of bacteria, spores.
What's the matter? Lowering the silver helmet.
I'm claustrophobic.
Oh.
Rez stared at her.
I heard of that. It means you're scared to be inside things.
She looked genuinely curious.
Small things, yes.
Like Sweet Jane?
Yes, but...
She glanced at the cramped cabin, fighting her panic.
I can stand this, but not the helmet.
She shuddered.
Well, Rez said, tell you what. We get you into the suit, but we leave the helmet off. I'll teach you how to fasten it. Deal? Otherwise, you don't leave my ship.
Her mouth was straight and firm.
Yes,
Marley said.
Yes.
Here's the drill, Rez said. We're lock to lock. This hatch opens, you get in, I close it. Then I open the other side. Then you're in whatever passes for atmosphere in there. You sure you don't want the helmet on?
No,
Marley said, looking down at the helmet she grasped in the suit's red gauntlets, at her pale reflection in the mirrored faceplate. Rez made a little clicking sound with her tongue.
Your life. If you want to get back, have them put a message through Jalterm for the Sweet Jane.
Marley kicked off clumsily and spun forward into the lock, no larger than an upright coffin. The red suit's breastplate clicked hard against the outer hatch, and she heard the inner one hiss shut behind her. A light came on beside her head, and she thought of the lights and refrigerators.
Goodbye, Therese.
Nothing happened. She was alone with the beating of her heart. Then the Sweet Jane's outer hatch slid open. A slight pressure differential was enough to tumble her out into a darkness that smelled old and sadly human, a smell like a long-abandoned locker room. There was a thickness, an unclean dampness to the air, and still tumbling, she saw Sweet Jane's hatch slide shut behind her. A beam of light stabbed past her, wavered, swung, and found her spinning.
Lights! Someone bawled hoarsely. Lights for our guest! Jones!
It was the voice she'd heard through the earbead. It rang strangely in the iron vastness of this place, this hollow she fell through. And then there was a grating sound, and a distant ring of harsh blue flared up, showing her the far curve of a wall or a hull of steel and welded lunar rock. The surface was lined and pitted with precisely carved channels and depressions, where equipment of some kind had once been fitted. Scabrous clumps of brown expansion foam still adhered in some of the deeper cuts, and others were lost in dead black shadow.
You'd better get a line on her, Jones, before she cracks her head.
Something struck the shoulder of her suit with a damp smack, and she turned her head to see a pink gob of bright plastic trailing a fine pink line, which jerked taut as she watched, flipping her around. The derelict cathedral space filled with the laboring whine of an engine, and, quite slowly, they reeled her in.
It took you long enough, the voice said. I wondered who would be first, and now it's Virik. Mammon,
And then they had her, spinning her around. She almost lost the helmet. It was drifting away, but one of them batted it back into her hands. Her purse, with her boots and jacket folded inside, executed its own arc on its shoulder strap and bumped the side of her head.
"Who are you?" she asked.
"Ludgate," the old man roared. "Wigan Ludgate, as you well know. Who else did he send you to deceive?"
His seamed, blotched face was clean-shaven, but his gray, untrimmed hair floated free, seaweed on a tide of stale air.
"I'm sorry," she said. "I'm not here to deceive you. I no longer work for Virek. I came here because, I mean, I'm not at all sure why I came here to begin with, but on my way I learned that the artist who makes the boxes is in danger because there's something else, something Virek thinks he has, something Virek thinks will free him from his cancers."
Her words ran down to silence in the face of the almost palpable craziness that radiated from Wigan Ludgate. And she saw that he wore the cracked plastic carapace of an old work suit, with cheap metal crucifixes epoxied like a necklace around the tarnished steel helmet ring. His face was very close. She could smell his decaying teeth.
"The boxes."
Little balls of spittle curled off his lips, obeying the elegant laws of Newtonian physics.
"You whore. They're of the hand of God."
"Easy there, Lud," said a second voice. "You're scaring the lady." "Easy, lady, 'cause old Lud, he hasn't got too many visitors. Gets him quite worked up, you see, but he's basically a harmless old bagger."
She turned her head and met the relaxed gaze of a pair of wide blue eyes in a very young face.
"I'm Jones," he said. "I live here too."
Wigan Ludgate threw back his head and howled, and the sound rang wild against the walls of steel and stone.
"Mostly, you see,"
Jones was saying as Marley pulled her way behind him along a knotted line stretched taut down a corridor that seemed to have no end.
"He's pretty quiet. Listens to his voices, you know. Talks to himself, or maybe to the voices, I don't know. And then a spill comes on him and he's like this."
When he stopped speaking, she could still hear faint echoes of Ludgate's howls.
"You may think it's cruel, me leaving him this way, but it's best, really. He'll tire of it soon. Gets hungry. Then he comes to find me. Wants his tuck, you see."
"Are you Australian?" she asked.
"New Millbourne," he said. "Or was before I got up the will."
"Do you mind my asking why you're here? I mean, here in this... What is it?"
The boy laughed.
"Mostly I call it the place. Lad, he calls it a lot of things, but mostly the kingdom. Figures he's found God, he does. Suppose he is, if you want to look at it that way. Near as I'll make it, he was some kind of console crook before he got up the will. Don't know how he came to be here exactly, other than that it suits the poor bastard. Me, I came here running, understand? Trouble somewhere, not to be too specific, and my arse for out of there. Turn up here. That's a long tale of its own, and here's bloody Ludgate near to starving. He'd had him a sort of business, selling things he'd scavenge, and those boxes you're after, but he'd gotten a bit far gone for that. His buyers would come, oh, say, 3 times a year, but he'd send them away. Well, I thought, the hiding here's as good as any, so I took to helping him. That's it, I guess."
"Can you take me to the artist? Is he here? It's extremely urgent."
I'll take you, no fear. But this place, it was never really built for people not to get around in. I mean, so it's a bit of a journey. It isn't likely to be going anywhere, though. Can't guarantee it'll make a box for you. Do you really work for Virik? Fabulous rich old shit on the telly. Crowd, isn't he?
I did, she said, for a number of days. As for a nationality, I would guess Herr Virik is the sole citizen of a nation consisting of Herr Virik.
See what you mean? Joan said cheerily. It's all the same with these rich old fucks, I suppose. Though it's more fun than watching a bloody Zaibatsu. You won't see a Zaibatsu come to a messy end, will you? Take old Ashpool, countryman of mine, he was, who built all this. They say his own daughter slit his throat, and now she's bad as old Lut, holed up in the family castle somewhere. The place being a former part of all that, you see.
My pilot said something like that. And a friend of mine in Paris mentioned the Tessier Ashpools recently. The clan is in Eclipse?
Eclipse, Lord. Down the bloody tubes, more like it. Think about it. We're crawling, you and me, through what used to be their corporate data course. Some contractor in Pakistan bought the thing. Hull's fine, and there's a fair bit of gold in the circuitry, but not as cheap to recover as some might like. It's been hanging up here ever since, with only old Lud to keep it company. And it him. Till I come along, that is. Guess one day the crews will come up from Pakistan and get cutting. Funny, though, how much of it still seems to work, at least part of the time. Story I heard, one got me here in the first place, said TAs wiped the cores dead before they cut it loose.
But you think they are still operative?
Lord, yes. About the way Lud is, if you call that operative. What do you think your boxmaker is?
What do you know about Moss Biolabs?
Moss what?
Moss, they make biochips.
Oh, them. Well, that's all I do know about him.
Ludgate speaks of them?
He might. Can't say as I listen all that close. Lud, he does speak a fair bit.
Chapter 27 Stations of the Breath. He brought them in through avenues lined with rusting slopes of dead vehicles, with wrecker's cranes and the black towers of smelters. He kept to the back streets as they eased into the western flank of the sprawl, and eventually gunned the hover down a brick canyon, armored sides scraping sparks, and drove it hard into a wall of soot-blown, compacted garbage. An avalanche of refuse slid down, almost covering the vehicle, and he released the controls, watching the foam dice swing back and forth side to side. The kerosene gauge had been riding on empty for the last 12 blocks.
What happened back there?
She said, her cheekbones green in the glow of the instruments. I shot down a helicopter, mostly by accident. We were lucky.
No, I mean after that. I had a dream.
What did you dream?
The big things, moving.
You had some kind of seizure.
Am I sick? Do you think I'm sick? Why did the company want to kill me?
I don't think you're sick. She undid her harness and scrambled back over the seat to crouch where they had slept.
It was a bad dream.
She began to tremble. He climbed out of his harness and went to her, held her head against him, stroking her hair, smoothing it back against the delicate skull, stroking it back behind her ears. her face in the green glow like something hauled from dreams and abandoned. The skin smooth and thin across the bones. The black sweatshirt half unzipped. He traced the fragile line of her collarbone with a fingertip. Her skin was cool, moist with a film of sweat. She clung to him. He closed his eyes and saw his body in a sun-striped bed, beneath a slow fan with blades of brown hardwood. His body pumping, jerking like an amputated limb. Allison's head thrown back, mouth open, lips taut across her teeth. Angie pressed her face into the hollow of his neck. She groaned, stiffened, rocked back.
"Hild man,"
the voice said. And he was back against the driver's seat, the Smith & Wesson's barrel reflecting a single line of green instrument glow, the luminous head on its front sight eclipsing her left pupil.
"No,"
the voice said. He lowered the gun.
"You're back." "No. Legba spoke to you. I am Samedi."
"Saturday?"
"Barom Saturday, hired man. You met me once on a hillside. The blood lay on you like dew. I drank of your full heart that day."
Her body jerked violently.
"You know this town well."
"Yes." He watched as muscles tensed and relaxed in her face, molding her features into a new mask.
"Very well. Leave the vehicle here as you intended, but follow the stations north to New York. Tonight, I will guide you with Legba's horse then, and you will kill for me."
"Kill who?"
"The one you most wish to kill, hired man."
Angie moaned, shuddered, and began to sob. "It's okay," he said. "We're halfway home." It was a meaningless thing to say, he thought, helping her out of the seat. Neither of them had homes at all. He found the case of cartridges in the parka and replaced the one he'd used on the Honda. He found a paint-spattered razor knife in the dash toolkit and sliced the ripstop lining out of the parka, a million microtubes of polyinsulation whirling up as he cut. When he'd stripped it out, he put the Smith & Wesson in the holster and put the parka on. It hung around him in folds, like an oversized raincoat, and didn't show the bulge of the big gun at all.
"Why did you do that?"
she asked, running the back of her hand across her mouth.
"Because it's hot out there, and I need to cover the gun."
He stuffed the Ziploc full of used new yen into a pocket.
"Come on," he said. "We got subways to catch."
Condensation dripped steadily from the old Georgetown Dome, built 40 years after the ailing Federals decamped for the lower reaches of McLean. Washington was a southern city, always had been, and you felt the tone of the sprawl shift here, if you rode the trains down the stations from Boston. The trees in the district were lush and green, and their leaves shaled the arc lights as Turner and Angela Mitchell made their way along the broken sidewalks to DuPont Circle and the station. There were drums in the circle, and someone had lit a trash fire in the giant's marble goblet at the center. Silent figures sat beside spread blankets as they passed, the blankets arrayed with surreal assortments of merchandise, the damp, swollen cardboard covers of black plastic audio discs, beside battered prosthetic limbs trailing crude nerve jacks. a dusty glass fishbowl filled with oblong steel dog tags, rubber-banded stacks of faded postcards, cheap Indotrode still sealed in wholesaler's plastic, mismatched ceramic salt and pepper sets, a golf club with a peeling leather grip, Swiss Army knives with missing blades, a dented tin wastebasket, lithographed with the face of a president whose name Turner could almost remember, Carter, Grosvenor, fuzzy holograms of the monument. In the shadows near the station's entrance, Turner haggled quietly with a Chinese boy in white jeans, exchanging the smallest of Rudy's bills for 9 alloy tokens stamped with the ornate Bama Transit logo. 2 of the tokens admitted them to the station. 3 of them went into vending machines for bad coffee and stale pastries. The remaining 4 carried them north, the train rushing silently along on its magnetic cushion. He sat back with his arms around her and pretended to close his eyes. He watched the reflections in the opposite window. A tall man, gaunt now and unshaven, hunched back in defeat with a hollow-eyed girl curled beside him. She hadn't spoken since they'd left the alley where he'd abandoned the hover. For the second time in an hour, he considered phoning his agent. If you had to trust someone, the rule ran, then trust your agent. But Conroy had said he'd hired Oki and the others through Turner's agent, and the connection made Turner dubious. Where was Conroy tonight? Turner was fairly certain that it would have been Conroy who ordered Oki after them with the laser. Would Hosaka have arranged the railgun in Arizona to erase evidence of a botched defection attempt? But if they had, why order Weber to destroy the medics, their neurosurgery, and the Moss Neotech deck? And there was Moss again. Had Moss killed Mitchell? Was there any reason to believe that Mitchell was really dead? Yes, he thought, as the girl stirred beside him in uneasy sleep, there was. Angie. Mitchell had feared they'd kill her. He'd arranged the defection in order to get her out, get her to Hosaka, with no plan for his own escape. Or that was Angie's version anyway. He closed his eyes, shut out the reflections. Something stirred deep in the silt of Mitchell's recorded memories. Shame. He couldn't quite reach it. He opened his eyes suddenly. What had she said at Rudy's? That her father had put the thing into her head because she wasn't smart enough. Careful not to disturb her, he worked his arm from behind her neck and slid 2 fingers into the waist pocket of his pants, came up with Conroy's little black nylon envelope on its neck cord. He undid the Velcro and shook the swollen, asymmetrical gray biosoft out onto his open palm. Machine dreams. Roller coaster. Too fast, too alien to grasp. But if you wanted something, something specific, you should be able to pull it out. He dug his thumbnail under the socket's dust cover, pried it out, and put it down on the plastic seat beside him. The train was nearly empty, and none of the other passengers seemed to be paying any attention to him. He took a deep breath, set his teeth, and inserted the biosoft. 20 seconds later, he had it, the thing he'd gone for. The strangeness hadn't touched him this time, and he decided that that was because he'd gone after this one specific thing, this fact, exactly the sort of data you'd expect to find in the dossier of a top research man. His daughter's IQ, as reflected by annual batteries of tests. Angela Mitchell was well above the norm, had been all along. He took the biosoft out of his socket and rolled it absently between thumb and forefinger. The shame.
Mitchell and the shame and grad school. Grades, he thought. I want the bastard's grades. I want his transcripts. He jacked the dossier again. Nothing. He'd gotten it, but there was nothing. No. Again. Again. Goddamn. He said, seeing it. A teenager with a shaved head glanced at him from a seat across the aisle, then turned back to the stream of his friend's monologue.
They're gonna run the games again up on the hill midnight. We're going, but we're just gonna hang. We're not gonna make it. Just kick back and let them thump each other's butts, and we're gonna laugh, see who gets thumped. 'Cause last week Susan got her arm busted. You there for that? And it was funny, 'cause Cal was trying to take him to the hospital, but he was dusted, and he ran that shitty Yamaha over a speed bump.
Turner snapped the Biosoft back into his socket. This time, when it was over, he said nothing at all. He put his arm back around Angie and smiled. Seeing the smile in the window, it was a feral smile. It belonged to the edge. Mitchell's academic record was good, extremely good, excellent, but the arc wasn't there. The arc was something Turner had learned to look for in the dossiers of research people, that certain signal curve of brilliance. He could spot the arc the way a master machinist could identify metals by observing the spark plume off a grinding wheel. And Mitchell hadn't had it. The shame. The graduate dorms. Mitchell had known he wasn't going to make it. And then, somehow he had. How? It wouldn't be in the dossier. Mitchell, somehow, had known how to edit what he gave the Moss security machine. Otherwise, they would have been on to him. Someone, something, had found Mitchell in his postgraduate slump and had started feeding him things. Clues, directions. And Mitchell had gone to the top, his arc hard and bright and perfect then, and it had carried him to the top. Who? What? He watched Angie's sleeping face in the shutter of subway light. Faust. Mitchell had cut a deal. Turner might never know the details of the agreement or Mitchell's price, but he knew, he understood, the other side of it. What Mitchell had been required to do in return. Legba, Zamedi, spittle curling from the girl's contorted lips. And the train swept into Old Union in a black blast of midnight air.
Cop, sir?
The man's eyes were moving behind glasses with a polychrome tint that swirled like oil slicks. There were flat, silvery sores across the backs of his hands. Turner stepped in close and caught his upper arm, without breaking stride, forcing him back against the wall of scratched white tile between gray ranks of luggage lookers.
Cash, Turner said. I'm paying New Yen. I want my cab. No trouble with the driver. Understand? I'm not a mark.
He tightened his grip. Fuck up on me. I'll come back here and kill you. Or make you wish I had.
Got it? Yes, sir, got it. We can do that, sir. Yes, sir. Where'd you want to go to, sir?
The man's wasted features contorted in pain.
Hired man.
The voice came from Angie, a hoarse whisper. And then an address. Turner saw the tout's eyes dart nervously behind the swirls of colors.
That's Madison, he croaked. Yes, sir. Get you a good cab, real good cab.
What is this place? Turner asked the cabbie.
leaning forward to thumb the speak button beside the steel speaker grid. The address we gave you? There was a crackle of static.
Hypermart. Not much open there this time of night. Looking for anything in particular?
No, Turner said. He didn't know the place. He tried to remember that stretch of Madison. Residential, mostly. Uncounted living spaces carved out of the shells of commercial buildings that dated from a day when commerce had required clerical workers to be present physically at a central location. Some of the buildings were tall enough to penetrate a dome.
Where are we going?
Angie asked, her hand on his arm. It's okay, he said. Don't worry.
God,
she said, leaning against his shoulder, looking up at the pink neon Hypermart sign that slashed the granite face of the old building.
I used to dream about New York back on the Mesa. I had a graphics program that would take me through all the streets, into museums and things. I wanted to come here more than anything in the world.
Well, you made it. You're here. She started to sob. Hugged him, her face against his bare chest, shaking.
I'm scared. I'm so scared.
It'll be okay, he said, stroking her hair, his eyes on the main entrance. He had no reason to believe anything would ever be okay for either of them. She seemed to have no idea that the words that had brought them here had come from her mouth, but then he thought she hadn't spoken them. There were bag people huddled on either side of Hypermart's entranceway. Prone hummocks of rag gone the exact shade of the sidewalk. They looked to Turner as though they were being slowly extruded from the dark concrete to become mobile extensions of the city.
Jamas,
the voice said, muffled by his chest, and he felt a cold revulsion.
A club. Find Damballa's horse.
And then she was crying again. He took her hand and walked past the sleeping transients. In under the tarnished gilt scrollwork and through the glass doors. He saw an espresso machine down an aisle of tents and shuttered stalls. A girl with a black crest of hair swabbing a counter.
Coffee, he said. Food.
Come on. You need to eat. He smiled at the girl while Angie settled herself on a stool.
How about cash? He said. You ever take cash?
She stared at him, shrugged. He took a 20 from Rudy's Ziploc and showed it to her.
What do you want?
Coffee, some food.
That's all you got? Nothing smaller?
He shook his head.
Sorry, can't make the change.
You don't have to.
You crazy?
No, but I want coffee.
That's some tip, mister. I don't make that in a week.
It's yours. Anger crossed her face.
You're with those shitheads upstairs. Keep your money. I'm closing.
We aren't with anybody, he said, leaning across the counter slightly, so that the parka fell open and she could see the Smith & Wesson. We're looking for a club. A place called Jammers. The girl glanced at Angie, back at Turner.
She's sick? Dusted? What is this?
Here's the money, Turner said. Give us our coffee. You want to earn the change? Tell me how to find Jammer's place. It's worth it to me. Understand? She slid the worn bill out of sight and moved to the espresso machine.
I don't think I understand anything anymore.
She rattled cups and milk-filmed glasses out of the way.
What is it with Jammers? You a friend of his? You know Jackie?
Sure,
Turner said. She came by early this morning with this little Wilson from the Burbs. I guess they went up there.
Where?
Jammers. Then the weirdness started.
Yeah?
All these creeps from Barrytown. Greaseballs and white shoes, walking in like they owned the place. And now they damn well do, the top two floors. Started buying people out of their stalls. A lot of people on the lower floors just packed and left. Too weird.
How many came?
Steam roared out of the machine.
Maybe 100? I've been scared shit all day, but I can't reach my boss. I close up in 30 minutes anyway. The day girl never showed, or else she came in, caught the trouble smell, and walked.
She took the little steaming cup and put it in front of Angie.
You okay, honey?
Angie nodded.
You have any idea what these people are up to? Turner asked.
The girl had returned to the machine. It roared again.
I think they're waiting for someone,
she said quietly, and brought Turner an espresso.
Either for someone to try to leave Jammers, or for someone to try to get in.
Turner looked down at the swirls of brown foam on his coffee.
And nobody here called the police?
The police? Mister, this is Hypermart. People here don't call the police.
Angie's cup shattered on the marble counter.
Short and straight, hired man,
the voice whispered. You know the way. Walk in.
The counter girl's mouth was open.
Jesus, she said. She's gotta be dusted bad.
She looked at Turner coldly.
You give it to her?
No, Turner said. But she's sick. It'll be okay.
He drank off the black bitter coffee. It seemed to him just for a second that he could feel the whole sprawl breathing, and its breath was old and sick and tired, all up and down the stations, from Boston to Atlanta. Chapter 28 Jaylene Slide.
Jesus, Bobby said to Jackie. Can't you wrap it up or something?
Jammer's burn filled the office with a smell like overdone pork that turned Bobby's stomach.
You don't bandage a burn, she said,
helping Jammer sit down in his chair. She began to open his desk drawers, one after another.
You got any painkillers, derms, anything?
Jammer shook his head, his long face slack and pale.
Maybe. Behind the bar, there's a kit.
Get it, Jackie snapped. Go on.
What are you so worried about him for?
Bobby began, hurt by her tone.
He tried to let those gothics in here.
Get the box, asshole. He just got weak for a second is all. He got scared.
Get me that box or you'll need it yourself.
He darted out into the club and found Beauvoir wiring pink hot dogs of plastic explosive to a yellow plastic box like the control unit for a kid's toy truck. The hot dogs were mashed around the hinges of the doors and on either side of the lock.
What's that for?
Bobby asked, scrambling over the bar.
Somebody might want in, Beauvoir said. They do. We'll open it for them.
Bobby paused to admire the arrangement.
Why don't you just mash it up against the glass so it'll blow straight out?
Too obvious.
Beauvoir said,
straightening up, the yellow detonator in his hands. But I'm glad you think about these things. If we try to blow it straight out, some of it blows back in. This way is Nita. Bobby shrugged and ducked behind the bar. There were wire racks filled with plastic sacks of krill wafers, an assortment of abandoned umbrellas, an unabridged dictionary, a woman's blue shoe, a white plastic case with a runny-looking red cross painted on it with nail polish. He grabbed the case and climbed back over the bar.
"Hey, Jackie,"
he said, putting the first aid kit down beside Jammer's deck. "Forget it." She popped the case open and rummaged through its contents.
"Jammer, there's more poppers in here than anything else."
Jammer smiled weakly.
"Here. These'll do you."
She unrolled a sheet of red derms and began to peel them off the backing, smoothing three across the back of the burnt hand.
"What you need's a local, though."
"I was thinking," Jammer said, staring up at Bobby. "Maybe now's when you can earn yourself a little running time."
"How's that?"
Bobby asked, eyeing the deck.
"Stands to reason," Jammer said, "that whoever's got those jerks outside, they've also got the phones tapped."
Bobby nodded. Beauvoir had said the same thing when he'd run his plan down to them.
"Well, when Beauvoir and I decided you and I might hit the Matrix for a little look-see, I actually had something else in mind."
Jammer showed Bobby his expanse of small white teeth.
"See, I'm in this because I owed Beauvoir and Lucas a favor. But there are people who owe me favors, too. Favors that go way back. Favors I never needed to call in."
"Jammer," Jackie said, "you gotta relax. Just sit back. You could go into shock."
"How's your memory, Bobby?" "I'm going to run a sequence by you. You practice it on my deck. No power, not jacked, okay?"
Bobby nodded.
"So dry run this a couple of times.
Entrance code.
Let you in the back door."
"Whose back door?"
Bobby spun the black deck around and poised his fingers above the keyboard.
"The Yakuza,"
Jammer said. Jackie was staring at him.
"Hey, what do you..."
"Like I said, it's an old favor. But you know what they say. The Yakuza never forget. Cuts both ways."
A whiff of singed flesh reached Bobby and he winced.
"How come you didn't mention this to Beauvoir?"
Jackie was folding things back into the white case.
"Honey," Jammer said, "you'll learn. Some things you teach yourself to remember to forget."
"Now look,"
Bobby said, fixing Jackie with what he hoped was his heaviest look.
"I'm running this, so I don't need your Loas, okay? They get on my nerves."
"She doesn't call them up,"
Beauvoir said, crouching by the office door, the detonator in one hand and the South African riot gun in the other.
"They just come. They want to come, they're there. Anyway, they like you."
Jackie settled the trodes across her forehead.
"Bobby," she said, "you'll be fine. Don't worry, just Jack."
She'd removed her headscarf. Her hair was cornrowed between neat furrows of shiny brown skin, with antique resistors woven in at random intervals, little cylinders of brown phenolic resin ringed with color-coded bands of paint.
"When you punch out past the basketball," Jammer said to Bobby, "you want to dive right, three clicks, and go for the floor. I mean, straight down."
"Past the what?"
Basketball. That's the Dallas-Fort Worth Sunbelt Co-Prosperity Sphere. You want to get your ass down fast all the way. Then you run how I told you for about 20 clicks. It's all used car lots and tax accountants down there. But just stand on that mother, okay?
Bobby nodded, grinning.
Anybody sees you going by? Well, that's their lookout. People who jack down there are used to seeing some weird shit anyway.
Man, Beauvoir said to Bobby.
Get it on. I gotta get back to the door.
Bobby jacked. He followed Jammer's instructions, secretly grateful that he could feel Jackie beside him as they plunged down into the workaday depths of cyberspace, the glowing basketball dwindling above them. The deck was quick, super slick, and it made him feel fast and strong. He wondered how Jammer had come to have the Yakuza owing him a favor, one he'd never bothered to collect, and a part of him was busily constructing scenarios when they hit the ice.
Jesus.
And Jackie was gone. Something had come down between them, something he felt as cold and silence and shutting off of breath.
But there wasn't anything there. God damn it!
He was frozen somehow, locked steady. He could still see the Matrix, but he couldn't feel his hands.
Why the hell anybody plug the likes of you into a deck like that? Thing ought to be in a museum. You ought to be in grade school.
Jackie!
The cry was reflex.
Man, said the voice. I don't know. It's been a long few days I haven't slept, but you sure don't look like what I was set to catch when you came out of there. How old are you?
Fuck off!
Bobby said. It was all he could think of to say. The voice began to laugh.
Ramirez would split his sides at this, you know. He had a fine sense of the ridiculous. That's one of the things I miss.
Who's Ramirez?
My partner, ex, dead.
Very.
I was thinking maybe you could tell me how he got that way.
Never heard of him,
Bobby said.
Where's Jackie?
Sitting cold-cocked in cyberspace while you answer my questions, Wilson. What's your name?
Count Zero.
Sure. Your name?
Bobby Newmark. Silence. Then.
Well, hey. Does make a little sense, then. That was your mother's place I watched those Moss spooks use the rocket on, wasn't it? But I guess you weren't there, or you wouldn't be here. Hold on a sec.
A square of cyberspace directly in front of him flipped sickeningly, and he found himself in a pale blue graphic that seemed to represent a very spacious apartment. Low shapes of furniture sketched in hair-fine lines of blue neon. A woman stood in front of him. A sort of glowing cartoon squiggle of a woman, the face a brown smudge.
I'm Slide,
the figure said, hands on its hips.
Jaylene, you don't fuck with me. Nobody in L.A.
She gestured. A window suddenly snapping into existence behind her.
Fucks with me. You got that?
Right, Bobby said. What is this? I mean, if you could sort of explain. He still couldn't move. The window showed a blue-gray video view of palm trees and old buildings.
How do you mean?
The sort of drawing
and you, and that old picture.
Hey, man, I paid a designer an arm and a leg to punch this up for me.